And so when we are asking our industrialized country partners why they are not willing to put the numbers on the table so that we can consider those ahead of Copenhagen, we are asking because we are under pressure because of the impacts, but their response is that politically and economically it's difficult for them to put these numbers on the table. And for us, when they are saying that it's politically and economically difficult for them, for us it is a question of life and death. People are dying in Africa because of the actions or the lifestyles in the north.
12 months after a massive multi-billion pound bailout of Britain's banks, they're getting almost another vast bailout, £40 billion more in public money. On top of that, there's to be a tax break for the Royal Bank of Scotland worth another £10 billion. The Conservatives call it a world record for bailouts, costing the equivalent of £2,000 per family.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mark. When there was earth to plow, or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job.
Yes, that's right. Just a week after the European Heads of State meeting was unable to agree any new money for poor countries in advance of the critical Copenhagen climate change talks in December, the British government manages to magic up out of nowhere another £39 billion of UK taxpayer money in phase three of our bailout of the banking system. Now that we own 84% of the Royal Bank of Scotland, are we making sure that they're doing the right thing with our money? On the contrary, Julian Oram of the World Development Movement, writing in today's Guardian, reports that since last October, RBS has lent £10 billion to projects and companies linked to climate change and other human rights abuses. And the government is fighting a challenge from WDM in the High Court that accuses them of acting unlawfully in not adequately assessing the risks posed by this ethics-free lending. And as the New Economics Foundation points out, the government is missing a trick in not restructuring the bank as a green lending bank that could kickstart our urgently needed transition to a zero carbon society. The government argues it would be unnecessarily restrictive and make the bank uncompetitive. Until our governments grasp the simple fact that, to paraphrase Archbishop Rowan Williams, the economy is a subset of the environment and not the other way around, then the fate of the majority of life on Earth will continue to dance perilously close to the edge. More UN climate talks are underway in Barcelona this week, the last, in fact, before the talks get underway in Copenhagen on the 7th of December. So in today's edition of the 300 to 350 show, we bring you a halfway report on proceedings using the voices of the majority world participants. In a breakthrough this week, the African group of around 50 countries effectively threatened a walkout, which put talks in the Kyoto Protocol track on hold for a day, before successfully refocusing the delegates on their central task of agreeing scientifically consistent cuts for rich countries after 2012. More on that in a moment, but first, here's Sudan, speaking for the 130 country bloc, the G77 plus China, rejecting the rich world's attempt to kill the Kyoto Protocol.
Mr. Chairman, the Group of 77 and China would like to reiterate its grave concerns about the implication of the call by Annex I parties to end the life of the Kyoto Protocol. The killing of Kyoto Protocol would have the effect of undermining the foundational principles of equity, common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities, and ultimately puts at risk any ambitious outcome to aggressively address climate change in Copenhagen as indicated by the IPCC. Mr. Chairman, clearly this attempt to make the Kyoto Protocol redundant and inoperable for a second commitment period goes back on the agreement reached in Bali to have a two-track outcome in Copenhagen with the continuation of the Kyoto Protocol for legally binding mitigation commitments of developed countries that have joined Kyoto on the one hand, and on the other hand, an agreed outcome that enhances the full, effective and sustained implementation of the Convention. Mr. Chairman, the Group of 77 and China would like to restate its strong position and to make it clearly known to the world that Kyoto Protocol must continue to form the legal basis for Annex I emission reduction commitments beyond 2012. And the Group of 77 and China is ready to stand against all attempts by developed countries to dismantle Kyoto Protocol, the only instrument we have for developed countries to take the lead in cutting their increasing emissions. Mr. Chairman, the Group of 77 and China would also like to reiterate its serious concern that Annex I countries have not yet made any progress in defining their quantified emission reduction targets, individually or in aggregate, which is the core element of the mandate of this important body. In this regard, we have only 5 days of negotiations here in Barcelona before Copenhagen. We would like to appeal to Annex I countries to take an ambitious quantified emission reductions for the second commitment period, in line with the principle of equity and their historical responsibility in causing climate change and its devastating impacts on the developing countries and limiting the prospects for sustainable development in our countries. We need to see the leadership that the entire world has expected to see since the establishment of this process in 2005, and we need it in order to make real progress and complete our clear mandate in Copenhagen and for the benefit of all humankind. I thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That was Sudan speaking for the 130 country bloc, the G77 plus China, at the opening plenary in the Kyoto Protocol track in Barcelona. What came next surprised everyone. Here's the Gambia speaking for the 50-country African group.
Mr. Chairman, according to the work programme of this group agreed in Poznan for 2009, we were to conclude Annex I parties' aggregate emission reductions in March-April session and individual contributions to the aggregate numbers in June 2009. As the most vulnerable continent, Africa believes that we should focus on the core elements of the mandate of this working group. In this respect, the African group would like to let you know that we would not accept any scheduling of any other contact group under this working group during this session unless and until the contact group on Annex I parties emission reduction concludes its works on numbers. I thank you for your attention.
That short statement threw the negotiating sessions in the Kyoto Protocol track into confusion, and the chair of the KP group spent the next 28 hours trying to find a solution that was acceptable to all parties. Here's Grace Akumu of the Kenyan delegation at the press briefing of the African group the next day, explaining the reasoning behind the move.
Africa is the most threatened continent, as you already know. If you take any country, I would perhaps use Kenya quickly as an example. We have already overshot the 2 degrees temperature increase, and that is threatening our survival as a continent. Kenya is just an example I'm using, but other African countries are also experiencing different impacts, but aggravated by the temperature increase. We can't afford to have negotiations stalemating, because I come from a country now whereby we are also losing livestock, we are losing human beings. We are having extensive droughts, and before this drought is finished, 3-year drought, we also have different parts of the country suffering from El Nino flooding. For poor economies like Kenya and other African countries, it's difficult to cope. And so when we are asking our industrialized country partners why they are not willing to put the numbers on the table so that we can consider those ahead of Copenhagen, we are asking because we are under pressure because of the impacts, but their response is that politically and economically it's difficult for them to put these numbers on the table. And for us, when they are saying that it's politically and economically difficult for them to put the numbers on the table, for us it is a question of life and death. People are dying in Africa because of the actions or the lifestyles in the north.
By the evening of the next day, the chair of the Kyoto Protocol Working Group had reached a solution.
Colleagues, you will remember the African group made a request to suspend discussions on all matters on the Lekapi, save and except for the issue of numbers. And in follow-up meetings with him and representatives of the African group, a request was made for me to hold consultations with members of other groups. Those consultations consumed the bulk of the time yesterday, stretched into last night, and into this morning. During the course of the day, we were able to arrive at a solution. And that solution is as follows. We will focus the bulk of our efforts in the group dealing with the numbers. More specifically, we have 10 slots between Wednesday and Friday when we ought to conclude our work. And we agreed that 60% of the time remaining, or 6 of the 10 meetings, will be devoted to the numbers group. Colleagues and I put that proposal before you for your general acceptance. Can I take it that the KP wishes to adopt that as its method of work here in Copenhagen, in Barcelona, and on to... yeah. So it's nice to look ahead. In objections, it's so decided. Thank you.
Here's how the African group responded.
The position we have taken is in no way intended to block the process, but on the contrary, to ensure that we have ambitious numbers in accordance with the dictates of science, and that demonstrates Annex I Party's leadership in addressing climate change. According to the AWGKP work program for 2009 agreed in Poznan, we were to conclude to Annex I Party's aggregate emission reductions in March-April session and on individual contributions to the aggregate numbers in June 2009. Mr. Chairman, we consider the current level of ambition stated by developed countries unacceptable and cannot proceed on assumption of a 20 to 30% cuts. We have to consider ambitious targets and numbers, and Africa's opinion is that Annex I parties shall cut by a minimum of 40%. Following fruitful discussions we had with you and the European Union and the Umbrella Group, we have agreed on the following: that 60% of the remaining time be allocated to the contact group on numbers, to discuss BASIA, length of commitment, etc., in order to enable us determine options to scale up the current pledges to meet the demand of science and the urgency of the situation. We have also agreed that all Annex I parties who have made pledges so far and those intended to do so indicate what percentage of their pledges are for domestic efforts, what percentage of their pledges are for offsets, and what percentage of their pledges are for LULUCF. We would like to assure you of our full cooperation in this process, bearing in mind that failure to achieve the desired results on the numbers contact group in tomorrow's discussions would give us no option but a suspension on the other contact groups. In conclusion, we would like to thank all parties in the G77 for their support and encouragement to the African group during the last 24 hours, and we look forward to a positive engagement tomorrow. I thank you for your attention.
The Africa Group then received statements of support and solidarity from many developing countries, including China, Sudan, India, Brazil, Egypt, Indonesia, and Grenada, speaking for the Association of Small Island States. Here's Bolivia with their statement of support.
And I just wanted to express very briefly the solidarity of my delegation with the African group. And just to mention that what you have heard the past few days is the words of frustration. A frustration of not having real progress on numbers for the second commitment period of developed countries. A frustration and a feeling that developed countries doesn't seem to take seriously the consequences that their actions are generating in our developing countries. A frustration, finally, that we don't have clarity on the numbers, that it seems that everything will be exported, will be offsetted, will be left to the markets, without leaving real responsibility and really acknowledgement of a historical responsibility of developed countries. In that sense, what we are looking is for real commitment, real progress, and real improvement on the numbers on the table as soon as possible, so we can leave Barcelona saying that we have made progress in a negotiation that has started long before the Bali action plans, and where there is no excuse anymore to keeping on delaying. As I mentioned, as a member of the G77, we'll be very looking and monitoring and looking very closely the next day on the developed countries to see how serious they are and if they can bring improvement in the numbers, so we cannot hear again the frustration coming from the parties again. Thank you, Chair.
Many poor countries, including the African group, are saying that the rich world should cut their emissions by at least 40% compared to 1990 levels. So what of the rich world's excuse that deep cuts are economically difficult for them? Alistair Doyle from Reuters put this question to a press briefing of the NGO umbrella group Climate Action Network International.
Alistair Doyle from Reuters. Again, it's a question about the 40%. That's also the position of the African group. Do you see any hope that the developed countries will go along with that? I mean, they say this will cripple their economies if they cut their emissions by 40%, and the numbers that are on the table from practically every country are nowhere near that. Do you see any chance that you're going to get any movement on that, any really big movement on that, or is it just going to be tinkering at the edges that you're going to end up in Copenhagen?
What else can we base our emission reduction targets on other than science? I mean, are we trying to negotiate and play diplomacy with science? What is the motivation of the developed countries in this business? Are we serious about really changing the way things are done for humanity?
I think also one sort of needs to know that I think a number of the emission reduction figures that have been put on the table have been discussed in a context, I think, that needs updating in the sense that developments, for example, in the EU, but also I think in the US, are such that, especially with the impacts of the economic crisis, that there are emission reductions already happening. There's also sort of a growing sense for the need to conserve energy. At the same time, you know, there are a number of policies that are actually are making an impact. In the US, there are a lot of sort of, there's a lot more renewable energy that's being put on the ground. All these things are already putting both the EU and the US on a trajectory that will lead to lower emissions than, you know, people were thinking their analysis a couple of years back. So there are figures for the EU that the cost that were originally calculated for the achievement of a 20% emission reductions over 1990, updated economic analysis says for the same money you can now get 30% in the EU. And, you know, the EU was already committed to 30%, so updating is required. The emission reduction figures are in the realm of the possible, both technologically and economically.
After the African group's useful intervention, which resulted in getting the Kyoto Protocol track to devote more time to its primary task in the wake of its scheduled overshoot, it seemed rather odd that the chair of the African group, Kamel Djemouai, of Algeria, was suddenly recalled to Algiers on the orders of the Algerian government. As The Guardian's environment correspondent John Vidal reported, other African delegations also received strong phone calls from their capitals. Here's John pursuing the story in the G77 Plus China press briefing.
Good morning, John Vidal, Guardian. Can I just ask whether you are aware that any African countries have been pressurized either yesterday or today by Annex One countries to back off after their intervention yesterday? It seems that you created quite a stir, not just here, but in capitals around the world. And we're hearing that the Algerian chair has returned dramatically or suddenly to Algiers, etc., etc. I mean, are you aware that there is any pressure being exerted by rich countries on African countries following their intervention?
Thank you. It's not new for developed countries to use all the means to try to prevail. They will use divide and rule, they will call president, they will call capitals, they will do all sorts of things. I think, John, you know very well what happened in Africa during the last 50 years. It was developed countries who supported dictators like Mobutu and the rest. But then the blame is on Africa, that we are corrupt governments. Millions of people were in prisons for fighting for their rights. So as far as that tactics is concerned, we would not be surprised if developed countries revert to such means. I have no any information as to whether that is what is happening currently. But let me say, that's not the best use of leadership. The best way, in order for developed countries to lead the world under what Obama has described as new multilateralism, is to create win-win scenarios.
While rich countries have been attempting to turn their backs on the Kyoto Protocol, people such as the UK Energy and Climate Change Secretary Ed Miliband have started talking about a single-track outcome at Copenhagen, which is politically binding. The phrase politically binding is a subtle but important change of emphasis, which only adds to the concern that rich countries are drifting dangerously towards the US position that the deal shouldn't be legally binding at the international level. Here's Ambassador Lumumba Stanislaw Diaping chair and spokesman of the G77 plus China again.
Now, the issue about whether there is a politically binding agreement and a legally binding agreement, I do not know of anything called politically binding agreement. If there is anything that you know about politics and political manifestos, etc., is that they are worth very little. Tell me of any politician who delivered on his political manifesto. Is it Gordon Brown? Is it Kevin Rudd?
You've been listening to the 300 to 350 show. Do visit the Climate Radio Archive to get references or to hear this show or any other programme in the series again. You'll find it at www.climateradio.org. The last word goes to the G77 plus China and their call for the will of civil society to be brought to bear in order to bring about the right solution in Copenhagen. Thanks for listening.
How much have developed countries put into addressing the financial crisis? The degree of urgency, the intensity of the effort, the ambition. Within a couple of months, 1.1 trillion was made available for global effort. Within 1 month, United States and Europe put more than, collectively, more than 20 trillions to address the financial crisis. Then why do you say that the life, the existence, the right to development by developing countries is not important? When you compare the two, you say that's heavy lifting. It cannot be heavy lifting unless you say some people are more equal than others. We cannot, and let me repeat this, we cannot accept total destruction as a choice for developing countries in order simply to appease some political leaders in the West. What we will do, we will engage with developed countries, governments, civil societies, intellectuals, church leaders, because we do believe that in developed countries, there are people who care. And their will must be brought to bear in the process to get us the right solution.